policymakers, like you said, Mike, are vol controllers and want to stifle volatility. If you look at the volatility of all assets, gold, stocks, bonds, currencies, they're all just record lows, which is kind of nuts because, like, geopolitically, things are like a mess. It's pretty impressive, honestly. That's why I say markets are a political decision.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Aura, the all-in-one application that protects your safety online powered by AI. Honestly, it is worse to just be a human that exists on the internet from a safety perspective than it ever has been before. I'm constantly getting weird scam phone calls from everyone. I'm sure you guys do too. There are lots of weird phishing attempts that are made to internal employees at Blockworks and on Twitter. So I have to do these posts that, hey, I'll never ask you for money. It just is terrible. The actual statistics is that 1 in 4 people now fall victim to cybercrime. And if you operate in crypto, it is even worse. You are more at risk. That's why we're happy to partner up with Aura here. And I'm going to be telling you all about them later in the show. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show. But for now, Mantra, thanks for making this episode possible.
All right, everyone, welcome back to another weekly roundup edition of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Tyler and Quinn. Fellas, how are we doing?
Good, good. Pumped to have Tyler back. Hopefully, yeah. Recovered. You look a little older, a little grayer,
a little wiser.
Yeah. Yeah. This is what we got to start with. Tyler, what does Vegas look like at 40, my man? How's your body doing?
Staying out past 12 a.m. is not good. You can see the bags under my eyes still. I was like, the drinking wasn't as bad as just not sleeping as much. Like, the sleep gets you. That's the oldest thing.
Tyler, before you got on, Quinn was like, yeah, I wasn't even hungover, man. I was just tired from staying up past midnight. I was like, oh my God.
It's so bad.
Yeah, that's what we have to look forward to.
Yeah.
I know. To your credit, though, Tyler, both Quinn and I were saying that a weekend in Vegas would take both of us out for a month. So you're in good company, man.
All right, not that quick.
Yeah. Can you give us like what did you do for the weekend, though? Was it like you
hit new
stables?
March Madness, right? So like everyone's, you know, it's a guy's emporium there. And we went to this place called Stadium Swim.
Wow, dude. Guy's Emporium. You know how to sell it, don't you?
I don't know. It's just like, it's part of like this degenerate culture. I mean, you can get into like some culture stuff, but like gambling is obviously getting opened up, and I don't know if it's good or bad thing, but yeah, it's a big weekend for guys to get away.
We're a nation of gamblers now, don't you know?
Yeah. I don't know if it's a good thing, but there's odds on everything now. Yeah.
The next boys weekend that I do, I'm going to make the title of the chat Guys Emporium. That's going to be the title of our
thanks
of the getaway.
Yeah.
All right, let's start talking a little bit about macro stuff here. Maybe we could actually just start with PC. Quinn, I saw you drop that right before we started, and this is, I mean, I would love to just get your guys' take here, because whenever it comes to anything surrounding inflation, it's like Tale of Two Cities, and all the inflationistas versus the disinflationistas start lining up. They look at the data, and it's sort of a Rorschach test, and people see what they want to see. Like Quinn, I saw the title of the tweet thread that you sent over is, you know, third straight month higher than where the Fed's target, but ultimately PC came in below expectations, right? So that actually feels pretty positive to me. I mean, what should we be taking away from the reading here?
Yeah, it is true. Everyone makes what they want of it, picks the dates that, or the data that corroborates with their story. I like this. That was a tweet from Jason Furman, and him and Krugman were going at it on Twitter about, you know, Krugman's still in, it's inflation was transitory, and kind of ignoring the upswing since mid last year. And this guy's arguing that it's been stronger. So yeah. Probably a bit lower this month, but January was revised higher. So it's maybe nets out to neutral. Maybe it highlights seasonality in January. I think the moral of the story is it's just not going away. That's the biggest thing, is that whether the inflection continues, you know, well above 3 into the 4s or it stabilizes here, and it's just not going back to 2. And I don't think it changes much for the Fed. We Powell knew this number last week or whenever when he spoke at the FOMC anyways. you know, he's kind of chalking it up to bumps in the road. And I just really think they're more focused on not letting unemployment, you know, go meaningfully above 4 before cutting. And I think at least 2 hikes are still on the table this year. So I don't think this changes anything. Probably a lot of just nothing burger per usual for these prints.
Isn't that a good thing for like growth? And I mean, inflation going up isn't necessarily a bad thing for the market if you have real growth. And that's sort of what we saw from GDP this week. So I don't know. I think these inflation prints, as long as they're moderate, aren't really
scary. Exactly. They're like the spending numbers, the growth numbers in this report, I think people agree were pretty pointing towards a strong economy. It just becomes problematic if the Fed has to start cranking rates higher to stop it. But they've told us a bunch of times they're biased to ease and don't really care that it's at 3. So let's take them at their word, and things probably just move on in a positive way from here.
Yeah, the 2s to 10s curve also like fell last week, and actually looks like it's kind of reinverting again, which is kind of an interesting thing. When you take the inflation narrative, you wouldn't expect that happening.
Tells me you got to stay long risk.
For now. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great, we've had Andy Constant on the show a number of times in the interview portion, and he's got this like 5-act play to kill inflation. And, you know, this like step 3 has been pretty persistently stubborn, where you see term premia start to compress, and that just hasn't happened. It's like the reinverting of the yield curve just means I feel like we've got more time left in this show before we really truly crush inflation and get to recession. But the other thing about the, all right, so let's say that the actual natural rate of inflation is higher than 2%, whatever, what, like maybe it's 3 or 4% or something like that. Do you guys think that the Fed has to get back to 2% to maintain its credibility? Because I don't know, you could interpret that as sort of the market could interpret that as a little bit of a sign of weakness. Even if 2% isn't realistic and the market sort of knows that it's not realistic, the Fed still has a mandate, right? And it looks like it would be a lot easier optically if they got back to 2% and said, hey, all right, now that we're at 2%, like this 2% doesn't really come from anywhere anyway. Like maybe we should raise it, as opposed to never actually getting back down to 2% and saying, oh, yeah, it's actually going to be closer to 3 or 4%. Looks like a little bit more of a loss. You know what I mean?
I don't think they need to get down to 2%. They can jawbone it all they want. And inflation actually helps lower debt to GDP. When you have more inflation, your debt becomes easier to pay off. So I think they might just keep saying 2% and run it a little bit hotter. So it helps the economy essentially delever. So that's where I'm.
I view their inflation target as something like their neutral estimate of neutral interest rate, which is fickle and changes based on backward looking data.
R star.
They're going to, yeah. It's like, why do people even talk about that? Everybody knows it's a made up number that they're going to change to fit their needs. You know, when they were keeping rates at 0, they said that R star need to be lower. And when they're going to keep rates higher because the economy's strong, they're going to raise it. And I think inflation's the same thing. When they change it, the target from 2% to the band where it's like, oh, we ran a little below, now we can run a little above. I think they just say what they need to fit what has to get done to keep the economy afloat and the markets afloat. And to me, that is, as Tyler said, a higher than 2% inflation target. But what would they do also if they're going to keep it at 3 to 4? They're not going to say, oh, we're actually at 3 to 4 now, because then that would, you know, catapult gold and commodities way, way higher. And that's just not what you do if you're trying to manage a situation.
Yeah, I think there's an element here of being like putting yourself in the shoes of these policymakers. And this is how I sort of felt. Do you remember a couple of years ago, everyone was calling for overt yield curve control in the US, and they're going to have to do yield curve control just like they do in Japan. Even if they do have to do something like that, policymakers aren't going to come out and say, this is what we're doing, right? That would just spook the market. They'd be really bad at their jobs if they did that. There are these kind of more subtle ways to accomplish those similar goals, right? And that's not being sneaky. That's just being good at your job and not spooking the market. That's doing what they sort of should be doing.
That's why the yield curve's inverted is because they, Janet ran down the TGA to 0 and didn't issue government debt for the first half of 2023. They stepped in with the BTFP with a facility to bail out banks, that there would have been a lot of treasuries dumped on the market. the October 22 thing, and then the QRA manipulation. It's all deal with Kirk control. And you just got to recognize the game we're playing, because it's not the same game we were playing 5 years ago. But you're spot on, Mike.
Watch what we do, not what we say. Right?
Yeah. I think, Tyler, you were the one who used this wording a couple of episodes ago, but it does feel like policymakers have just become much more sophisticated in terms of controlling the software that underlies monetary policy. Like, they've just gotten a lot more sophisticated than they used to be when they were trying to affect the same changes, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Doesn't it seem like that?
You know, the question I keep coming back to is, the older I get, I'm like, are markets always a political decision? Or, like, has it always been that way? Or were there pockets of, like, free market capitalism, like, in the 90s, maybe in the 2000s? Or has it always been, you know, we need pensions to be fully funded? I would love to know your perspective on that.
I think there probably were bouts of it, but I think there was also many bouts of highly manipulated environments. Because when things are going well, like let's say maybe around when Clinton had a balanced budget type of timeframes, when things are managed appropriately fiscally, you don't need all these bells and whistles and duct tape measures to make sure the wheels don't completely fall off. But you look back to the 70s, you know, removal of the gold standard and all the stuff going on there, again, a major turning point in history where things were extremely, extremely manipulated by global, not just US governments. So I think it just ebbs and flows, and the different market regimes dictate, you know, how much political. But the increasing debt balance is what I think further corners the decision makers. Like, your available range of tools becomes less and less as you get trapped up against this wall.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. We partnered with Aura for this episode to keep On the Margin listeners safe from cybercrime. I talked about it at the top of this episode, but cybercrime and phishing scams have basically become the bane of my existence. I get 10 spam calls every single day, every day. And I'm sure you guys do too. And my co-founder, Yano, has actually been hacked multiple times, you know, knock on wood, God forbid, this past year. So it's just never been less safe to operate on the internet, especially if you work in crypto. It's particularly tough. That's why we partnered up with Aura, which is an all-in-one app that provides protection for your identity, financial accounts, passwords, devices, all of that stuff. Now, the benefit of Aura, there are many benefits, but one, it's AI. So you immediately get notifications if someone is trying to hack into your bank account, social media, whatever it is. So you know really quick. But in addition to that, what they do is they will actually help you solve the problem. So with 24/7 US-based support and dedicated resolution agents, Aura will actually be there every step of the way to help you resolve whatever is happening on the fraud front. And for a limited time, because Aura just loves On the Margin and you guys as listeners, we are getting a free 14-day trial plus 55% off an Aura subscription when you visit aura.com/blockworks. Only get that discount if you go to aura.com/blockworks, which we've linked in the description. So go check them out. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security-first, compliance-focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions into Web3. So you guys have heard me talk about Larry Fink talking about tokenization. You've seen the clips on CNBC. You know that Larry and BlackRock are very, very excited about this idea. And the reason for that is they're looking at these trillions of dollars of off-chain real-world assets. They want to digitize those and bring them on-chain, which is going to be a massive opportunity. But in order to do that, they need a compliant L1, and that's where Mantra comes in. Mantra's been steadily climbing the ranks and now stands among the top 4 RWA projects on CoinGecko, which is representative of its rapid growth and influence in the tokenization space. Mantra's built using the Cosmos SDK, so they have some very cool stuff out of the box. They've got IBC interoperability. They also leverage CosmWasm smart contracts. Very cool design from an architectural standpoint. The next phase on the blockchain's testnet is Hongbai, so that's launching soon. So if you're a dApp developer or something like that, there's a lot of very cool opportunities for you. And I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of the show notes. I don't know that I sent you. Thanks very much again, Mantra, for making this possible. And again, guys, click the link at the bottom of the show notes.
I think it's probably like Quinn said, there are times when, I mean, ultimately, what are governments trying to do, right? Like, if you don't have your tinfoil hat and think they're trying to, you know, defraud everyone, I really think they're mostly trying to keep the wheels on. And, yeah, if you think about what governments and people are just trying to do, we're just trying to coordinate to produce better outcomes for everyone. And there are probably times when things are going well more generally and governments don't have to step in quite as much. And then there are times when things aren't going quite as well and they do need to step in, manipulate the system, reset the incentives, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I joke with a buddy of mine gave me this framework a couple of years ago. It sort of makes me laugh. Every once in a while, you sort of hear from kind of the more conservative sort of doomer short seller corner of macro that it's all manipulated, you know, and then they're just making the stocks go up. And it's like, yeah,
they are. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't we want that in a certain sense, right? Like, yeah, they're trying to tip the scale so that net net things go up. And that's probably a social good. Like, shouldn't we be trying to do that? And it's, you know, you don't want to overtly manipulate it and do it in stupid, unsustainable ways. But yeah, that's kind of the difference between things like equities and commodities. Like, they have a totally different natural set of incentives where if equities go down far enough or long enough, policymakers will move heaven and earth to make them go back up. It's the exact opposite for commodities. If they go up far enough, policymakers will move heaven and earth to make them go down because people actually have to use commodities. Like, look at what the SPR, the government did with the SPR last year. So I don't know. I think probably it's always a little bit of a political tool, but at times when things are more broken, the administration has to step in more. Sometimes there are good results with that, and sometimes there are bad results.
Well, I think this is the point where we're so used to this markets as a utility, like it's becoming a geopolitical asset. Markets are. And at this point, I think the Bitcoiners know they're stuck. They're stuck in this, like, between a rock and a hard place. They have to print. They have to do yield curve control. They have to do all these, like, little things at every hint of some sort of credit crisis, because there's so many political decisions that have been made for the past 40 years with entitlements that there's just no way out. And I think the public's kind of waking up to that. And I wonder what's going to happen, because, like, if free markets really happen through, like, cryptocurrency, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Like, in the super, you know, crypto vision of the world.
Well, the unfortunate thing for crypto is we're still in that commodity bucket where there's not this upward drift that policymakers, you know, it's the opposite. They want to try and, you know, similar to gold, you know, is this release valve that actually signals problems at the top of the authority. So
yeah.
That we're bucking the trend is good.
I agree with, I actually think the way to look at all of these crypto, or like the L1s, you know, like Bitcoin. I know some people want it to only be Bitcoin. If you want it to be that way, that's an opinion to have. But I view this as like the creation of a new digital commodity. And we're at the beginning of like a new digital commodity super cycle. And I think the Bitcoiners got this absolutely right from day one. They just, like, they saw something going on in the world. They just nailed it and they stuck with it for such a long period of time that, yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Tyler. I think the Bitcoiners kind of correctly intuited that governments and markets were sort of stuck and there was going to have to be some sort of release valve. But I do think all, like, this sort of, you know, this phase one of crypto that we've all been living through is this, like, crazy commodity boom. But I think ultimately what we've created here are mostly commodity-like assets. So speaking of crypto, I know we don't want to talk too much about this, but SBF, he got his sentencing this week, which I would just, if I could do a public service announcement and make one ask, I would love for mainstream media outlets to stop calling this guy the crypto king. It's like, if you look up SBF sentencing, it's like 7 out of 10 headlines, like, crypto king gets sentencing. It's like, no one calls him that. No one's ever called him that. And I would love it if we could just stop using that, but he got 25 years.
Sounds like you're jealous. Like,
no, absolutely not. It's just, shut up. It's just annoying. It's just annoying that people are calling. It's giving him this. Anyway, so here, I've actually got a chart. Bloomberg put together a, you know, white collar defendant prison terms. And, you know, whenever it comes to this, this obviously depends on whether or not you were directly impacted or you have friends or family that were impacted by what SBF did, if you lost your money, et cetera. But, you know, if you look at, you know, Bernie Madoff obviously got much more prison time, but SBF is basically the second most, he got the second most time for white collar crime. You know, he's ahead of Jeff Skilling, of Enron, Elizabeth Holmes, Martin Shkreli, et cetera. So, I don't know. I mean, we can, you know, skip over this and not talk about it too much, but what are your guys?
I want to know this question because, you know, everyone's probably talked to this SBF crap nonstop on all these mundane points. How did it affect your business specifically? And what was the vibe during the time? And how did it change crypto, really? Because everyone has these like stupid mainstream media things that they put on it. But I feel like you guys have a really unique perspective on this. Can you talk to that at all?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, first of all, there's the, whenever it comes to something like this, there's like the human side of it. And I'm not speaking on behalf, like I didn't personally lose money. There are a lot of people that did lose a lot of money. And there are a couple people that committed suicide based on these losses. So like, first and foremost, whenever you're talking about something like this guy just, it was just a horrible, shameful waste and just wanton, just reckless destruction. Like can't say enough bad stuff about SPF, the guy, and the harm that he personally caused to people. I want to get out there as well, because there have been all these headlines recently about claimants getting 100% of their money back. That's actually not true. What they got was 100% of the crypto value at the time that FTX collapsed. So you could imagine, right, when FTX collapsed, the auditor, like the executors of the estate, whatever, they took a snapshot of the amount of assets that you had on FTX at the time, and you're going to get 100% of that back, most likely. But, you know, all of those assets, like the Bitcoin or ETH or Solana that you had on the exchange at the time, is worth, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 times that amount. So you are definitely, like, I just want to get that out there, that creditors were 100% not made whole in terms of this. But, you know, in terms of how it impacted Blockworks, and maybe there are a couple of ways to answer that question. Like, obviously negatively at the time. And I think one of the challenging parts of that as well was people that, you know, Blockworks has a bunch of employees that this is their first like cycle in crypto. And whenever you're dealing with, you know, you're going through sort of bear cycles, you have to deal with people that haven't been through one before. And there's like a challenge of faith, right? Like, am I going to make it through this? Is crypto ever going to come back, et cetera? And FTX definitely made that a lot harder, because usually what happens in these crypto cycles is just that Bitcoin sells off a bunch. Everyone calls it a fraud and a scam. And it just sort of like, I don't know, lingers in this like weird limbo before it comes back. But this was the first cycle where there were just actively negative headlines, you know, this parade of like indictments, negative headlines the entire time. And if you have a more normie background, I mean, that's just pretty tough for your psychology to stick around. So I'd say that was a big challenge internally for people at Blockworks. Maybe I have like a little bit of a contrarian take here. I am not sure overall that FTX really ended up mattering in the grand scheme of things. And again, I want to say that not from the perspective of anyone that was directly affected. Obviously, if you lost money on FTX, you were directly impacted. But, you know, just look at the mania that played out in markets in 21 and 22. It's like whatever goes up that fast must come down. If it wasn't FTX, it was most likely going to be something else. And in 2018 to 2019, that bear market was, by almost all objective measures, worse in terms of the severity, the depth, how long it was. Like, that was a worse time, and we didn't have an FTX. Like, that was a more challenging bear market to live through, at least from my perspective. And the market has basically fully come back. And so I'm not sure ultimately it ended up mattering that much in the grand scheme of things, to be honest with you.
To that point, the Fed had like negative real rates of like 4%, 5%. And you're going to get sociopaths that do crazy stuff in that environment and lever up and super risk, whether it's Nikola Motors or, you know, my friends over at Muddy Waters, Carson Block and Freddie Brick are like, you know, you get sociopaths everywhere when money's free.
Right.
You know, the rates are negative. And so it just happened in crypto way worse because it had the narrative, right? It had all the things, and SBF was the face of it. But yeah, I think that a lot of it has to do with the Fed liquidity when it got way too liquid.
He's a scumbag, and he committed extreme fraud. He stole money, and then he's a horrible trader. He lost billions of dollars, and he caused dozens of bankruptcies and tons of job loss and value destruction. I think it's tough to, I'm no judge or moral, you know, but I think he really did a really bad thing here.
Absolutely.
Spent too much time on the guy. Hope he enjoys his time.
Yeah. Quinn, I've got a question. So here's one thing though, that might've actually, that FTX might've impacted, and is the credit creation apparatus that used to exist in crypto that has just not been built back almost at all. It feels like to me. So when I say the credit creation apparatus in crypto, what I mean is these lending desks that used to, you know, that used to give out a whole ton of borrowers. So that was like the genesis of the world. That was, you know, BlockFi, et cetera. And, you know, back in the beginning of last cycle, late 2020, early 2021, there was just huge amounts of loans that were going out. And that was really this sort of hidden source of leverage, this sort of incestuous flywheel between, frankly, like Genesis and GBTC that was just creating an enormous amount of leverage in the system. And it just doesn't feel like that was one of the most impacted sectors of last cycle's blow up. I sort of thought people would have a short memory and sort of start to build that back up, and they just haven't at all. And I wonder if that's maybe why the beginning of this cycle feels a little bit more
measured.
Yeah.
Well, it's done with cash instead of, you know, massive leverage.
Yeah, it's true. It's a factor. It's this weird thing where historically interest rates in crypto have been inversely correlated to traditional interest rates, because when the Fed and traditional interest rates go to zero, it moons crypto, increases the demand for on-chain dollars and digital dollars and stables within the crypto ecosystem. There's a huge shortage. Funding rates skyrocket and interest rates on-chain go really high. And that creates this relative value premium for money to flood into the crypto economy to go after and close that arbitrage, where 21 traditional interest rates were 2% and or 0 to 2%, and crypto interest rates were like 15%. And so tons of money flooded the system. It was a very, very large misallocation of capital in the grand scheme of things. And it led to, you know, firms that got credit facilities not that shouldn't have, and all these dislocations. So there was many credit events, Luna, Celsius, BlockFi, et cetera, before FTX. That was the big and the worst one. It was kind of the nail in the coffin. But it has changed that landscape. If you think back to how BlockFi started, which was really like one of the early pioneers on the crypto lending, it was a legitimate business. They were providing high net worths, you know, financing against their long-term crypto holdings. And you have whales and other long-term investors for tax reasons that don't want to sell. And they're able to get dollar liquidity against those. When you go to a bank, I might have, you know, $10 million in Bitcoin and want to buy a $1 million house, but you go to Chase and they recognize that as zero. And I don't want to sell that because I'm going to have a huge cap gains bill and I want to buy a house though. So there were very legitimate use cases for lending. And grew from that into then DeFi yields and all these other more speculative things that probably shouldn't have had as big of allocation of credit as they did. So I think it's a healthy, there's a lot of learnings from it. It destroyed a ton of value in the process. So you wish there was ways, you know, it hurt a lot of retail, because all these, as we've seen from those cases, a lot of these companies were made up of retail. But it is a much healthier overall environment. Yes, we talk about funding and open interest and futures being high, which is a source of leverage. But I think that's one thing people forget is all the, Tyler, as you said, hidden leverage, the amount of capital being allocated to these trading firms and such last cycle was quite astronomical. So it's a much healthier, overall healthier development and market structure today. Maybe if the Fed goes print mania again, it comes back, but we'll see.
BlockFi was actually like a pretty good product. I didn't use it in terms of like, I remember borrowing against my ETH, and it was the most simple process of, you know, you borrow, they give you the cash, And compared to getting, I just got a credit line on my house, and it was like, took 2 months, 3 months to do.
That was for your Vegas trip?
Yeah. Oh yeah. not red. That's why I'm looking. So,
well, there was a structural imbalance in that market between the demand and supply side of that market, which was part of the challenge. And just to put the book on the SBF part of this conversation, hopefully it's the last time this guy ever gets mentioned on this podcast. I agree with Quinn. The guy was a scumbag. He got what's coming to him. Might have even should have had more. But so when I said it, he didn't ultimately end up mattering. That's not, again, like he didn't cause an enormous amount of damage. I just meant in the overall like value proposition of crypto and like how cycles ultimately end up playing out. I'm not sure, like with the benefit of hindsight, it's going to have had a massive impact. But you know what? One of the sort of like path dependent sort of interesting thing that's happened, because SBF almost personally blew up the entire centralized lending apparatus. And a potential silver lining, although maybe something to be sort of worried about going into this cycle, is you see a lot of that getting rebuilt on chain, which I would argue is a huge positive, like net good. And frankly, like for Blockworks, like we sort of built our business on serving some of these more centralized CeFi type companies. And that has changed quite a bit over the course of the last couple of years. Like frankly, the companies that have the most traction now are companies that are building on-chain infrastructure and protocols. And just to point to you a couple data points, these aren't necessarily even customers of Blockworks, but you know, you can see this in like the NFT exchanges are a really great example of this. Like OpenSea used to be dominant. They had like 98% of market structure, or sorry, they had like 98% of market share, crazy profits. And look at what's it called? Blur has just completely eaten their lunch. OpenSea, you know, no offense to anyone there, great company at one point, et cetera, but it looks like they've just sort of fumbled the bag. Same thing over on Solana. You know, you've got Tensor that now has something like 70, 75% of that market share. That's what it looks like is happening across the board. Like companies are building on-chain infrastructure. Now, what I would say as well, like to caution investors and users, is just because it is on-chain doesn't mean that it is necessarily 100% safe. And Quinn, I would love to get your thought on this because, you know, when everything was blowing up last cycle, people sort of pointed and said, look at all of these CeFi business models. These things don't make sense. The DeFi companies all held up well. And I think there were a couple of things that are behind that. One, in protocols like Aave and Compound, those loans were over-collateralized, which in theory, that does actually make it safer. But the other thing that's happening from an on-chain perspective is those businesses were just much smaller. Their lending books were smaller. So when the lending books are smaller, you don't have to reach as much, you know, once you've maximized. So you can basically just like, there's sort of this like low, almost like low hanging fruit market that you can just lend to on good terms, do your DD, et cetera. I think the challenge that BlockFi ran into is they were a VC backed company. They had to keep growing exponentially. And at a certain point, you run out of borrow, except for like the Three Arrows Capitals of the world, and they didn't want to post the collateral. So then you have to make this deal with the devil. Do I like keep growing my business and to get the valuation that I need to get to raise the next round? But I'm going to have to ultimately not have as many, you know, protections on the investor side of things. And I think that is the challenge that they ran into. And fundamentally, that's going to be a challenge that exists for protocols that exist on chain also. So I would just say like going into this next cycle, just because something exists on chain does not mean that it's risk-free. And please do not think like that if you're a user or investor.
Yeah, we had plenty. I mean, there's billions lost in hacks and stuff on in DeFi, so nothing's perfect. I think on the CeFi side, the bulk of the problems were, it was around transparency though, because it was in these are in the court documents for the Celsius and BlockFi. Like they got dinged the hardest for advertising their loan books as collateralized when they were maybe 10 to 30% collateralized and largely under or uncollateralized. So if you know that going in as an investor, lender, whatever, you can appropriately assess risk. But it was, there was a level of deceit that actually not, you know, if it was collateralized or collateralized by Bitcoin or ETH and not FTT and Serum, you know, a lot of these problems wouldn't have been so daisy chain and it would have looked more like DeFi. But yeah, I think there's a middle ground. You just stay away from fraud and lies, then he should be okay.
That's probably sound advice. Well, that's the kind of alpha that you come to this show for.
That's right.
let's move a little back onto the macro side here. And Tyler, I know you were talking a little bit about this sort of momentum trade that's been placed. So I'm going to throw some of these charts up here. If you could just walk folks through this, I'm just going to turn it over to you here.
Sure. Okay, so this is the S&P top 50 correlation. The blue line is the implied correlation, and the orange line is the realized correlation. So basically what this is showing you is that all stocks are at lows in correlation, which they have their own personality. The correlation of one is when everything goes up at the same time, everything goes down at the same time. In that environment, you have the VIX spikes because everything's acting the same. And this is a great stock picker's environment where we're in right now, where correlations, they all have their idiosyncratic personalities. However, this also kind of like keeps implied volatility low across the entire universe of stocks. So the VIX kind of has been pretty muted. So anybody who's been buying VIX calls or S&P puts or Q puts, it's really hard to make money when vol is smushed like this, because of a lot of strategies. And what that's done is actually, you could probably put up the next chart. It's forced people into the winners. And this is the momentum factor. So basically all the stocks like semis, some large cap tech things, everyone's piled into there because volatility is low. All these quant funds have all these factors, and momentum is one where if a stock keeps going up, you just keep riding it, right? That's the basic premise. Now, if you look at this chart, we're basically at, you know, a stretched level where we were in like early 2002, right before we saw this giant rotation out of large cap tech into small caps. And I think that's sort of the environment we're heading into. You can kind of see the allocation on these rotations from large cap tech into IWM. And you can see the outperformance there. So I think what's going to cause the rotation is oil's kind of creeping up here. Oil crossed $83 a barrel. It's just kind of sneaking up. XLE, all the oil stocks are perking up here. And that'll generally cause an exodus outside of large cap tech, which has been the momentum factor trade. So I could see going forward kind of a rotation out of that momentum factor into kind of more small cappy things.
Mm. How much of the correlation implied versus realized, you know, being at multi-year lows is, do you think, due to interest rates being higher and off zero?
I don't know. I think it's more about just the path of interest rates in like unforeseen circumstances that can really get thrown if there's a spike in oil or a geopolitical event, or, you know, a giant tech company completely blows earnings, which could happen here. I think a lot of the AI narrative is pretty frothy. You know, the NVIDIA stuff, the SMCI stuff, all you need is like one event here and you'll get a massive rotation out of that momentum factor. And a lot of funds are piled into that right now.
It's funny because in 2022, this obviously, this trade, right, late 21, really early 22, this trade began in terms of like, let's just call it the IWM or XLE or over QQQ, you know, outperformance, the tech from tech in 21 into commodities and more inflation protected sectors. And, you know, it caused this huge bear market broadly in indices, but these subsectors performed really well until ultimately it became too painful. And we've got this just, you know, recurring pattern we talked about earlier, the covert yield control from the Fed stepping in. And it seems like this is just a continuation of that, where eventually, you know, things, and I think we're seeing it, all the juice being squeezed from the inflation that's kind of possible without actual damage to the economy. And then, you know, we're up against that point where it's like, all right, we tried to bottom inflation and it's doing it at 3 and kind of reflecting back up now as consequence of the Fed stepping in and bolstering everything for a year and a half since October 22, for a year and a half since they started that. And of course, you're going to see reverse, disinflationary effects?
See, I think we're in a larger cycle from capital to labor here too. And you had the disinflationary, as they tightened, and now the underlying movement from capital labor, like this Boeing thing is actually very fascinating. They're going to take a Boeing union member and put it on the Boeing board for the first time in like years. And think about that. Unions have been not on boards for 40 years. That was like one of the big things is like, you got to, create shareholder value. And now this Boeing thing is changing stuff. Starbucks, I believe, did it too. And so this underlying thing from capital to labor could be very inflationary underneath. And to your point, could just have be a persistent higher inflationary level on wages and commodities and all these other things going forward. And I think that's sort of where we're at. It doesn't mean we'll spike like we did when they poured lighter fluid on the economy with fiscal and monetary policy. I think this is probably going to be a little bit more steady and the market might not go down. Like David Zuros, I'm kind of in that camp where a little inflation might be good for stocks. In fact, over a long period of time, people might sell their bonds and go into stocks. So that's sort of where my head's at right now. It's the unforeseen like spikes in oil or unforeseen spikes in interest rates, which they're trying to avoid. They're vol controllers. Policymakers, like you said, Mike, are vol controllers and want to stifle volatility. If you look at the volatility of all assets, gold, stocks, bonds, currencies, they're all just record lows, which is kind of nuts because like geopolitically, things are like a mess. It's pretty impressive, honestly. That's why I say markets are a political decision.
You know what's so obviously there's tons of stuff going on in the world right now. On the geopolitically things are a mess type front, do you think it always sort of feels like that though? Doesn't it always kind of feel like, even if you rewind the clock back to
No. You know why?
No.
Because things like there's institutions like this P. Diddy stuff. There's people who are their legends are falling right now. Like this is the fourth turning. That's why I think it's different. It's this why is the heroes of this generation are the villains of the next. And this is the fourth turning. And this is why I feel like this is different.
That was the first thing that came to mind. I had a conversation yesterday and it's whether it's that sort of thing, which is, not like we don't need to go into that, but all along the way, 10 years ago, those types of people, the Bill Cosbys, the Weinsteins, like they wouldn't even gotten in trouble. They knew they were so rich and powerful. It wouldn't even been surfaced. Today it's surfaced and they're getting in trouble in the future. So it's the loss of trust in these institutions, but more what you're saying, Tyler, it used to be money and power that is transitioning into the last thing I think is getting the 80-year-old politicians out of the seat. And
actually, all the leaders are false prophets. I'm going to just say it right now. A lot of them. I shouldn't say all of them. Ron Paul has been pretty consistent. He could be the great leader. But besides him, there's a lot of people that have just been co-opted by a lot of different weird surreptitious things. And it's all coming out now. I think that's why like the Bitcoiners kind of get it. They're just like, nothing surprises me now. And that's the underlying thing, what's going on.
I could buy this. I mean, the thing that, I don't know, I'm torn between being very optimistic and positive about this versus being sort of slightly worried about it also, because the trend that, like Tyler, back to your labor capital point, honestly, the trend that you and I have been talking about for years is this populism trend. And populism is concerning. Usually, if you go back in time and look at history when populism was rearing its head, those were not necessarily fun times to be alive. And sometimes those populist reforms led to things that actually translated into real good. Often, I would argue, much more often, they don't.
Yeah.
They really don't.
But they are they're rooted in a more fair and equal, like they're not rooted in bad. They're rooted in pushing for an equal playing field. And so I think
Hitler.
Hitler was a populist. That guy wasn't pushing for some things he was pushing for.
But the pendulum has just swung too far into capital, into rich, into away from the labor side. And that's And that's what happens. And whether the ultimate outcome is a good one or a bad one will depend on how strong our systems are and our, you know, to effectuate it. But I don't think the movement itself, at least in the US, is rooted in negativity.
Here's, you know what, an interesting example of a guy that would be a little bit more complicated than Hitler, who's just pretty objectively bad, would be Napoleon, who you may or may not consider a more traditional populist, but he definitely had populist sensibilities. And okay, he waged all these wars. His legacy has changed over time as well. So pre-Hitler, he was sort of the Hitler figure. He was not looked upon well from the rest of Europe. I mean, he led these wars, caused a lot of death, but he also did create essentially the modern nation state, that concept. He also did, you know, most public infrastructure, public policy, legal stuff in France is based on Napoleon. He had some really good humanist sort of reforms. I don't know if people know this, his background. He wasn't even French. He grew up in Corsica. You know, he spoke with an Italian accent for his life. Honestly, that guy's got one of the crazier stories of anyone in history. And it's cool. You can actually go back, and as he was leading these like wars and invading Russia and shit, he's like writing about how trash should be collected in France. He's like personally writing these letters. Like, how did you hold all that in your mind, my guy? But yeah, there are. So I guess to your point, maybe there are. But usually, all right, here would be a really cynical, but a sort of way that I believe this kind of works is, like, look at what Trump did. Trump basically said Trump is an elite, but he correctly identified that there was a massive hole in terms of like the people, like a populist sort of hole where he could, whether or not you really believe that he actually is on people's side or whatever, he was just like, there's this whole group of the population that isn't being served. I'm going to take their interests as a political tool. And this is what happened. Like, I don't know how familiar you guys are, like, Peter Turchin and his sort of theory about elites and surplus elites. Yeah, he basically traces all conflict in human society back to surpluses and deficits of elites. And usually when you have populists, they're always elite people themselves, but they take on the mantle of being, quote, for the people because it's the politically expedient thing to do, which sort of like kind of resonates. I know.
Yeah, but I think take a guy like Elon. Elon, you would no doubt say is more populist now, like, than he is anything else. But the guy's responsible for like many of the top inventions in the world, and I think he has good intentions. So yes, there's these cases where maybe you can question the person's intentions or goals of the situation, but you just have to try and get those right people in power. I mean, you can say stuff about Elon, but the guy, he's responsible for some of the most, you know, advancing technologies.
Did you hear why he supported Doge? It was because he was walking down the factory line at Tesla, and some of the guys were like, "Hey, Elon, you gotta support Doge." And so he goes, "I am a man of the people. I'm going to support Doge." And that's how the bubble started in it. I mean,
wild.
You gotta kind of like that a little bit, even if you're an Elon hater.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know about Elon's intentions. You have to at least respect the accomplishments, right? Everything that he's done. Honestly, people, obviously Tesla's going to end up being his primary legacy, but SpaceX is probably more impressive even than Tesla, I think. Mm-hmm.
There's like 10 other companies too.
Yeah.
It's Starlink is like the greatest business ever. It's like 90% margins, and it could just change our world, but no one really knows it's coming.
Yeah, it's pretty bananas. And I mean, he didn't, you know what I've never really respected the Elon critique of is, well, some people say he just got lucky, which is, I don't even know how you can be intellectually honest with yourself and say that. But, you know, when he got fresh off of X, you know, he made a couple $100 million in early days of the internet with like online payments infrastructure, right? And it would have been super easy at that time to just raise a bunch of money for some other internet startup. And he went and tackled basically two of the hardest problems that you could possibly think to tackle, which is electric cars and space. That just doesn't foot intuitively with the idea of a guy who is just trying to phone it in.
Here's a question for you.
Easier ways to do it.
This is what's funny to me is this whole 30 years or the Peter Thiel thing about there's been advancement in bits and not atoms. is it easier for him to do those things? Because capital, no one's courageous enough to take on the high capex type projects, the engineers to sell that to investors. Maybe that's what it took. Like, because the courage to do that is so in, there's not enough supply of that, that it was kind of easier. And then the engineers, once you have the capital, you get the engineers. We just need more of those people to have those visions and do it.
I'm not sure that VC is the right funding model for Adams, if that makes sense. Like, if you go back and look at some of the Adams businesses, that I feel like that has to be some sort of mix of government funding as well. And
there's a lot of stuff like DARPA is doing a lot of this stuff, public partner, non-dilutive capital.
Yeah.
And I think that's the next big thing is VCs who do defense tech and like incentivize guys that like Vannevar Bush, who created like all these crazy technologies. That's all this VC of the past 15 years and these jokers that just like talk a big game and really don't know how to do VC or see anything in the future. It was just a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. Mostly. I mean, there's a lot of smart guys out there, but I think those guys are probably some of the worst investors. Like, we saw it with FTX, and to bring it full circle, like, it was just guys throwing money and doing zero due diligence. And now I think people are realizing, oh my God, we should have been really putting money towards like real ideas and real hardware. I think that's the next big stage.
Well, here's a middle ground for this, is that the venture funding model works for a certain type of business, which is mainly software businesses, right? That's the type of business profile where, like, the VC funding model is this. You take a bunch of pot shots and one of those things returns something like 100x that the winner pays for all of your losers. And the business that fits that type of profile is usually like a software or internet enabled type company, right? That's not good or bad. It's just a very different investing skill set. And we probably just had too much money going into this one particular funding mechanism that supports this one type of business. There just needed to be other types of investors, other capital formation that happened outside of this VC, like VC SaaS company thing, right? Like, there are these types of businesses that would be really helpful for humanity, like the Adams part of the world, but maybe that requires a different funding mechanism than VC. I don't think it's like, oh, these guys are so dumb and they don't know what they're doing and there's smart guys over here. I just think it's we just put too much capital to work in this one particular vehicle. And I got to run here in a minute because I'm actually got my sister's wedding and it's gotta get off to that in a minute. But can we just pour one out for the latest attempted short of MicroStrategy? So I don't know how many times I've seen this over the years. This is Carisdale Capital. I don't even know who these guys are, but they just came out with their long BTC, short MicroStrategy. Actually, it's kind of a funny title. Know when to hodl, know when to fodl. That made me laugh. I got to be honest. But
I mean, love the effort. I think
I did too.
It's going to work. Like, obviously, everybody, right? You know, it's kind of in that territory where it's a more meme than value, but you got to get the timing right. And the tough thing about these pairs is it's a reflexive thing that by putting on the pair, you're longing Bitcoin, which puts upward price pressure on Bitcoin. And MSTRs, the higher Bitcoin goes, the more reflexive the MicroStrategy premium can get. And we know how that goes. So good luck. I hope they, I mean, as a person who's put this trade on a couple of times, luckily I've never, it was in July and the ETF launch day in January. You know, it can have really good results. I think April's a strong month, so I'm a little more skeptical at this timing though.
I can tell by Tyler's face that he wants to put this trade on real bad.
No, I'm abstaining from commenting on any of these. This is a hero trade.
This is. How is our coin versus Bitcoin bet going?
Yeah, I haven't actually checked.
Let me check. I think I'm up. So when did we put that
time frame?
We said June. Yeah. I don't think we came up with a specific. We should just say on
March 1st. And I'm up for sure.
We could do March 1st to June 1st. And then the loser, they could also buy me a dinner too. We could throw that in as an additional term. I think that feels right.
Yeah.
Totally correct.
We'll take Tyler's winnings from Vegas.
I actually did win $8,000. Don't tell them.
Oh, all right. Damn. That's pretty good. All right. Nice.
I got the IRS on speed dial in case you don't pay up on this bet.
The key is I actually woke up in the morning and hit the blackjack table, and I didn't do anything special. I just got a string of good cards. But you never win money past like 11 p.m. ever.
Yeah. I thought you told your wife you only won $2,000. You're going to get ousted on this show.
The rest of that $6,000 is going into Barca lounges for the man cave in Tyler's place. So,
yes, 100%.
For the dude's emporium.
Yeah.
Is there a more guy's emporium than a Barca lounger? The ladies just hate the Barca loungers, but they're so comfortable. You know what hits? Dude, you know what? All right, so I've started to go back and watch these old sitcoms that just hit much more as I've gotten older. And you go back and watch Friends. Like, you know, Joey and Chandler, they just had these two loungers in the middle of their living room. I was like, wow, that is the most dude apartment like thing I've ever seen. Just didn't register when I was like 14 watching it. You know what I mean? But anyway.
on that note,
not
to drag this out, but have you guys watched like Angels in the Outfield or Rookie of the Year, all these like 90s movies, like Heavyweights? I'm watching them with my kids right now.
Heavyweights is fire.
They're literally incredible. And these movies now are so bad. What happened to the writers? Like, you can still watch these movies like Mighty Ducks, and you're
they
like,
got lived up.
We watched Cool Runnings the other day. Everyone's got like tears in their eyes at the end. Like, what is going on with like the media nowadays is just terrible.
Well, it's
mainstream.
I think there's a profoundly negative tilt on most mainstream media that comes, and that has expanded to like, have you guys seen this new like Civil War movie that's coming out from, I think it's A24 or something
that?
It's just the zeitgeist. It's just, I think, especially coming from the left, this perception of like, we're descending into this pit of doom. The world is ending, yada, yada. It's just so negative. It's just everything that comes out.
The new kids' movies are made by the people that made the Google AI thing.
Yeah, that is, I think that is what it is.
It's just a bunch of crap. Well, the depression rates are off the charts too for, you know, did you see that chart? I posted it on my Twitter, but it was like, you know, kids who are teenage years have like skyrocketing depression.
Yeah. And,
all these problems we'll solve when we get real leaders in there, boys.
So I'm going to show this
podcast. Get outside and watch 90s movies. That's
I'm going to show this podcast for the 1,000th time on this show, which is The Rest is History. I'm listening to this Martin Luther, like this. It's going to be a 6-parter on Martin Luther. And you know what's funny is in the 1400s, everyone was depressed because they thought the world was coming to an end. Christendom was ending and yada, yada. Like, there were literal predictions that the world was going to end in 80 years or something like that back in the 1400s. So it didn't, and it's not going to now, and you should probably just relax a little bit. And it is, I noticed this during COVID especially. It was just like, man, there's just a tale, not to get really political here, but there was just tale of two cities going on in the US, and it did feel like there was just this one group that was just almost making the choice to be really negative and depressed about it, and you could just have not done that. I don't know.
So, if you're long Bitcoin, you're probably not depressed.
Yeah, probably.
as it's at all-time highs. Yeah, I can confirm I'm not.
Yeah. And confirm. All right, fellas. This was a really fun one.
Have a good weekend.
Next week. Yeah.
You guys.